butt was that? Well, this is this is Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. And I'm glad that you've joined me today. We're off to a great start. This is the Marketplace of Ideas, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed in the open form of talk radio, and I look forward to engaging you in that discussion. 1-800-227-5278 is my number in the 714 area code, Orange County, Southern Cal, 754-4150. Line's wide open here, and I'm looking forward to talking to you. And thank you, by the way, for tuning into the show. Whether you're listening live in our broadcast footprint here in Southern California or live through streaming on the World Wide Web, and that would be at KBRT740.com. If you go to dubs.KBRT740.com, you can listen to our show anywhere in the – well, actually, anywhere in the world. And so welcome to you who are listening through live streaming, and welcome to you who are listening by MP3 download. And I think probably within maybe 7 to 10 days – you will be getting a notice if you're enrolled there or registered on our website that we will be starting podcasting, so you can subscribe to that. So that's all coming up, and it's just going to make it a lot easier for you to listen to the show. But however you're listening, I'm glad that you're with us. By the way, hour number two today, Dr. J.P. Moreland is going to be joining us, and he's going to be talking about some of the things that are happening around the world in terms of the advance of the gospel advanced through signs and wonders. It's easy to think that, gee, it's a tough job around here to get the gospel out. People are just bored. But how come we're doing so badly? Well, it might seem that way here in the States, but it isn't that way around the world. And JP is going to weigh in with some of the stories and accounts of what's actually going on. Last weekend I was gone, and what do we have, a best of or something? We haven't run out of those yet, have we? I've been gone so much here, but I'm back now live and lively, 1-800-227-5278. Last weekend in Dover, Delaware, had a great time with the church there and was given a book by Chuck Smith Jr. You know Chuck Smith. He's, if you're in Southern Cal, you sure do. He's the pastor, founding pastor of the First Calvary Chapel, which is the epicenter of the Jesus movement here in the late 60s, early 70s in Southern California. Chuck Smith Jr. is his son, who is a pastor, and I don't know if it's still a Calvary Chapel now, if they call it that anymore, but he's in San Juan Capistrano area here in Southern California. The book that was given to me is entitled Frequently Avoided Questions. It's co-authored with Matt Whitlock. And it says at the top, an uncensored dialogue on faith. One of the things that caught my attention, by the way, published by Baker, which is my publisher for relativism. That's painful. Because at the top is a recommendation by Brian McLaren. I highly recommend this book. On the back, a word by Brian McLaren and Leonard Sweet, both significant movers in the emerging church movement. Now, I'm going to be talking about knowledge and truth and the emerging culture tomorrow night at Biola University. If you missed my talk for the Master's Series and you're in Southern California, I'll be at Biola University tomorrow evening. I think the talk actually starts at 7:30, so you can beat the traffic, you know, or you could, you know, if you get stuck, you can still come out to that. I'm speaking about the same thing, and that is truth is a strange sort of fiction. I'll be talking about postmodernism and its impact on the church. And it seems like every time I turn around, I pick up a new tome by someone in the emerging church movement like this one, Frequently Avoided Questions by Chuck Smith Jr. and Matt Whitlock. Henceforth, I'm just going to refer to Chuck Smith Jr. since you'll know that I'm talking about both authors. I have not read this book. I've only read parts of it. I open it up to think places that look interesting and challenging, and so I can't give you a full assessment of the book or a full assessment of Chuck Smith Jr.'s theology/philosophy, but I'll tell you one thing. Every time I open this book, I see something I don't like. I see the dark side of the movement, that is, a complicity and a giving in to a postmodern point of view. Now, it looks pretty cleverly written, as is usually the case from those writing in this movement. And there is always an admixture of truth and error, it seems to me. That is, they touch on things that are problematic, that are difficult, that either are hard for evangelicals, according to the old school, and he contrasts the new school and the old school. He is in the new school. The old school would be, I guess, people like his dad and people like me, who he also refers to as fundamentalists, which is a pejorative term. But there is this tone through the book that's similar to other emerging books that I've read. I just wanted to point out a particular passage here to, as an illustration of the kind of thing that concerns me. I am deeply, let's see, how can I put this? I am in debt to many of the emerging authors like Chuck Smith Jr., because they have an uncanny ability to find the problem. I mean, they do a good job. In fact, even though I know a lot of the problems, and this is something that Stand to Reason is concerned about, they do a better job than me. And I'm good at finding problems. It's a mixed blessing. Fortunately, I mean, it's actually a vice that I was able to figure out how to get paid for. So I make a living at it, and I watch it becoming too bizarre and negative. But still, even so, these guys are better at it than me. They find more things that are troublesome about the church, and I mean this quite genuinely, need to be dealt with. So we owe them a gratitude in that they point out ways in which our conduct, our traditions, our way of doing Christianity is counterproductive not only to a postmodern age, but probably to some degree to the culture that we kind of found ourselves in as in a more modernist culture. So there's a lot to learn here. The problem is the answers that are given. As J.P. Moreland put it in his address to ETS a year and a half ago, their antidote is the cure that kills the patient. And I want to give you an example of that because, and I'm going to read to you a page to see, first of all, how nicely written this is, how it has a certain kind of appeal, especially to people that are a little bit doctrinally on the fringe of Christianity, which makes up about 95% of all church-going Christians, in my view. When I say doctrinally on the fringe, they're just, their doctrinal knowledge is fringe. They know a couple of things, but they don't see how it all fits together. And therefore, when somebody comes along with a well-written challenge that seems to make sense from a perspective, they're easily taken in. This isn't just 95% of the adults, but it's almost all of the young people to whom this book is written. Let me just read a couple of the chapters, by the way, so to bring you up to speed. It's an uncensored dialogue on faith, which means it, and frequently avoided questions. So this already starts out kind of iconoclastic. This is daring. This is bold. Frankly, in the circles I run in, there are uncensored dialogues on faith all the time. Maybe in certain fundamentalist environments this isn't allowed, but in any way, frequently avoided questions, what would some of these be? Why the Bible? These are titles to the chapters. Do I have to go to church? Do I have to sell God? It's the evangelism question. Can Christianity be reduced to steps or stages? Does God speak outside the Bible? Is forgiveness real? What makes the Christian experience unique? Are Christians the morality police? Do good people go to hell? Does the Bible contradict evolution? Am I supposed to hate the world? Are there gay Christians? Is it wrong to take a job in a bar? And where is your God is the closing chapter. Now, as I look through the contents and page through the book, it doesn't strike me that these are frequently avoided questions, again, in my circles, but maybe in Chuck Smith Jr.'s circles they were. In any event, I keyed in on the chapter, Do Good People Go to Hell?, and buzzed through it quickly to see what he had to say and ended up on the last couple pages where he gives an illustration. And here he talks about, the heading is, What Would You Say? Now, this is a fair question, by the way, given what he writes. What would you say? I'm going to read this to you, and I want to ask you, what would you say? He writes, a young woman sits down with a church minister to discuss funeral arrangements for her mother. She tells the pastor, my mother was not a religious person. I don't think she ever went to church, and she never read the Bible or spoke of Jesus, but she was the best person I've ever known. She raised us by herself, never complained, was always there for us, and met our needs. She was kind to all my friends, never judged anyone else, never said anything bad about anyone else. Even though she rarely had enough money to buy something for herself, she frequently gave $2 or $3 to homeless people on the street. I could go on and on. The more the minister talks with people who knew the young woman's mother, the more he discovers that everyone has the same opinion of her. They cannot say enough about how wonderful she was and how she made the world a better place. Every person honors her. She was a woman whose life was marked by love and goodness and beauty and generosity. The minister, in fact, wishes that there were more Christians in his church who lived the type of life exemplified by this woman. By the way, can you identify with that? Are there people that you know that are outside of the church who have no religious affiliation of any kind, yet seem to be just charmed, wonderful, charming? I mean, I've seen them. There's no question that there are people like this. And you often think, gee, why couldn't Christians be as good as this person? You know who one of my models is for my Christian life? He's a non-Christian, by the way. His name's Dennis Prager. The way this man comports himself in public and dealing with the issues he deals with, much like the issues I deal with, is a wonder to me. And I watch him to absorb the way he does this. And you should too if you can listen to his show. I say frequently, if not publicly, to friends, and I reflect on it myself, why can't more Christians be like Mr. Prager, especially in his ability to engage religious topics intelligibly and intelligently without sounding like a religious nut? Anyway, the piece continues here by Chuck Smith, Jr. After the memorial service, in which the woman was eulogized by 7 or 8 different people who had only excellent things to say. Of course, what else would you say at a funeral service? The young woman returns to the minister and asks this question. Remember, this is under the heading, What Would You Say? Here's the question. Is my mother in hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart? Now, that's the question, isn't it? Chuck Smith Jr. says, I've been put in this position a number of times. How do we answer the question? Now, as I mentioned a few moments ago, there is an advantage to reading this kind of material by people like Chuck Smith Jr. who are in the postmodern emerging stream of Christianity. And that is, they put their finger on something that's wrong. Because there is something wrong with this question. Is my mother in hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart? Well, there's nothing wrong with the question, really. It's just that the question reflects something this woman has heard from other Christians. And what she's heard from other Christians is that if you don't believe in Jesus, or in this terminology, ask Jesus into your heart, then you're going to hell. And we have given the impression that it is belief in Jesus or non-belief in Jesus that is the thing that keeps us out of hell or puts us in hell. I think this is a mischaracterization of the gospel. And I think Chuck Smith Jr. is identifying an error in the way we've communicated. By the way, I talk about this a lot. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, I've given talks about the so-called heathen and the unknown God twice, just in the last few weeks, to address this question. In some version of this question, I address all the time when I talk to audiences, because we are, every time I talk about being an ambassador, because we are miscommunicating. If non-believers raise this question, is my mommy going to hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart? Well, we have not given a robust characterization of the gospel. In fact, if you read the way the gospel is communicated in the book of Acts, no one, I think, who was listening to the apostles communicate the message there would ask this question this way. Now, of course, at the heart of it is the issue of whether Jesus is the only way. But notice the way the question is asked. Am I going to go to hell because I didn't believe in Jesus, or in this case, the woman's mother? And the answer to that is no. Nobody goes to hell because they didn't believe in Jesus. They go to hell for a different reason if they do go there, but not because they didn't believe in Jesus. Now, could Jesus have rescued them? Yes. But when someone dies of cancer, we don't read on their epitaph or in their obituary, cause of death, stupidity, wouldn't go to the doctor. The doctor isn't, or lack of the doctor is not the cause of death. The doctor could have saved them, presumably, but the doctor is not the cause of death. It is the illness, it is the cancer, it is the disease that kills. Jesus is the doctor. He's the insulin, as it were. And if one avails himself of what God offers, then they are healed of their moral disease, but it is the disease that kills. And this is where we've missed it. Now, what troubles me, though, is the way that Chuck Smith Jr. answers. He says, I've been put in this position a number of times. How do we answer the question? Is my mother in hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart, even though she was a wonderful, godly woman, better than most Christians, though she was not religious, subtext there. How do we answer this question? And then he offers, yes, I'm sorry, but this wonderful person, who is your mother, will burn in hell for all eternity, despite her kindness and love. And then he asks, does this answer make sense? I'm not asking right now if it can be supported by a string of biblical texts, he says, but is it logical that an all-good, all-wise, all-loving God, whose second greatest commandment is that we love one another, would take pleasure in allowing this person to suffer for all eternity? Is this the answer Jesus Christ would have given her? Had he been asked the question in the Gospel of Mark, the immoral woman who kissed Jesus' feet and washed them with her hair, Jesus forgave her, even though the woman did not ask Jesus for forgiveness. So now he's suggesting, it seems like this is a counterexample to help us answer the question. By the way, he says, does this answer make sense? Don't give me Bible verses. Just think, does it make sense? And then he gives you two quotations from the Bible that he thinks makes his point, contrary to the fundamentalist view, the old school view. Would the same Jesus tell the young woman whose mother died that even though her mother was a good person and lived much closer to his teaching than many of his followers, she would be tortured forever? Well, it's clear that Chuck Smith doesn't think Jesus would say such a thing, nor could he say this to this young woman. Although when Jesus was asked point blank about this kind of question, he had a point blank answer. Unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. John 8. He who believes is not judged. He who does not believe is judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. John 3:36. So Jesus did have something to say to this issue, and he spoke quite clearly. But is that the way we answer this young lady? When we return, I'm going to tell you how I would have responded, and I have another question for Chuck Smith Jr. on this issue. I understand the sensitivity of the circumstance, but this doesn't mean that we then bail on sound biblical teaching. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will emcee all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction vision and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul exhorted him in 2 Timothy 2:14 to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason chose it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry as well. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. And my encouragement also to go to our website at str.org and just check out the information on the cruise coming up September 16th through 23rd. That's going to be a lot of fun. New England in the fall, Canadian Maritimes, 1 week with great teaching and instruction, great fellowship. Please check it out. Love to have you on board. Boston, Bar Harbor, Halifax, Sydney, Charlottetown, Quebec City, and Montreal, all part of the same cruise. So I hope to see you on that. Also a reminder that tomorrow night I'll be at Biola University in La Mirada at 7:30. It's the Defending the Faith kickoff lecture in Sutherland Hall. That means it's a freebie, but there'll be a lot of people there. That hall holds 800, and we filled it up more than once. So you want to get there early for that. And if you need information about that event, 888-332-4652. I'll be talking about just an incredibly important thing, postmodernism, in a much more sophisticated way than I've done in the past, talking about relativism. Truth is a strange sort of fiction. In fact, I will be giving the same talk in an abbreviated version at Aliso Creek Presbyterian Church on Sunday in the Sunday school there at 11 a.m. So that's in Laguna Niguel, the Aliso Creek Presbyterian Church. I'll give you the number there. It's 949, area code 460-0080. That's 460-0080, 949 area code. Sunday at 11 in Aliso Creek Presbyterian Church. Talking right now, just giving some reflections on Chuck Smith Jr.'s book, Frequently Avoided Questions. It's kind of like an apologetics book for emergent types. But as we've said in the past, the emerging church is a broad group, a broad movement. There are a lot of different beliefs, and in many ways it's a style as much as it is a belief system. But we have also said that there are those who are on the cutting edge of training about this movement that have not only are seeking to adapt the message to a new culture, that is changing our methods to adapt the message, but are actually changing the message. I think Chuck Smith Jr. is doing that, though he grew up, as I mentioned, at the epicenter of the Jesus movement. He ought to know better when he raises questions like the one he's raised in this book. Under the chapter, Do Good People Go to Hell?, the young lady asks of her mother, who died without Christ and without religion, but was, as he's characterized, a better person than most Christians, is this woman going to hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart? Would Jesus actually say this? He said he didn't say that to the woman who wiped his feet with her hair and washed it with her tears. She was given forgiveness. Now there's some explanation for that probably, but the suggestion here is it would be cruel to say to this woman at her mother's funeral that she is going to hell just because she never heard of Jesus, didn't ask Jesus into her life. Especially when she's a better person than most Christians. Now, I expect Christians to stumble at this point, the rank and file. I said 95% are on the fringe theologically. They just don't understand very much. I do not expect Chuck Smith Jr. to get this wrong. Let me ask a question of Mr. Smith regarding this situation. What if the woman who died of cancer because she was a chain smoker? And the daughter came to him and said, you know, I smoke. People are telling me that my mom died just because she smoked. Is the same thing going to happen to me? Are you telling me that just because she smoked, she died? Are they right? What do you think Chuck Smith Jr. would say to her in the circumstance? My suspicion is he would try to be as gentle and gracious as possible with the woman, or maybe this is a teenage girl who asked this question of her dead mother. And he'd say, you know, this is a hard question to answer under circumstances like these. The fact is your mom was a chain smoker and she died of lung cancer. There's a connection between the two. We know that. She took a risk and she paid for it. I'm so sorry that you lost your mom. It's tragic. It's terrible. But if you ask me, would she have lived longer if she hadn't smoked? Honey, I got to tell you the truth. I think she probably would have. It's hard to know. For sure. But the good news is, there's a silver lining here. You don't have to make the same mistakes your mother made. You can decide now not to make that mistake. You can quit smoking now and not have to face this thing with your children 30 or 40 years from now. Now, it seems to me that would have been an answer that would have been truthful, giving a proper warning considering the gravity of the circumstances, but would not have been insensitive. Couldn't he do this with the gospel? Is it true that this woman who dies without Christ will be punished? The answer is yes, not because she didn't ask Jesus into her heart, but because of a disease, a moral disease that is sin, because of rebellion. God judges people for rebellion and for crimes committed against him. If you commit no crimes, nothing to worry about. You could be a wonderful person all your life, but if you still have crimes there, you got to pay for them. You know, the government doesn't give you a letter after, you know, you haven't kind of showed up on the rolls for a few years and say, you know, I noticed you haven't committed any crimes recently. Go out and knock off a few gas stations. You got credit on your account. We're expected to obey the law. And when we obey, we've just done what we're supposed to do. And when we break the law, we get punished. The same thing is true with God. We're expected to obey God and do all the wonderful things that were characterized here by this woman before she died. Wonderful person that she was, better than most Christians. The fact is, she wasn't a perfect person. She still had rebellion against God, and for that, she'll have to answer. It's her sin that gets her punished, not her lack of believing in Jesus. That's the antidote. Jesus could have saved her. Now, why couldn't Chuck Smith Jr. said under these circumstances that you and I face if we're vocal about the gospel? When asked, is my mother in hell because she never asked Jesus into her heart? Why can't we say, you know, this is a really hard question to answer right now? It's difficult. Your mother was a wonderful person. She's a better person than I'll ever be. We might say that. The fact is, as much as it hurts us to think about it, she's going to have to give an account for her life just like everybody. And if she ever did anything wrong, she's going to have to answer to God for that. Now, if she had trusted the provision of forgiveness that God gave through Jesus, then she wouldn't have to worry about that. The fact is she didn't, and so she's going to have to stand alone before God. She will not be treated unfairly or unjustly. She will be judged only for those crimes that she committed, such as they are. But the good news is, you know now in advance, you can take advantage of the pardon that God freely offers to you so that you're not caught in the same place in the future. That when you pass on for whatever reason, regardless of how good your life was, your children won't be asking the same question and I won't be giving the same answer. Everybody falters. Therefore, everybody has to answer unless they receive the forgiveness God offers through his Son. Why couldn't he say that? You see, there is no reason for ambiguity, equivocation, uncertainty on this issue if we've read our Bibles. I'm reading through the book of Acts now. You cannot read through the book of Acts and look at the testimonies and the testifications of by the apostles, people Jesus trained himself, as they talk about the cross, and miss this. People desperately need Jesus, and when we don't say so clearly, we are aiding and abetting their condemnation. Oh, well, we can put it in words like this. We could say, oh, God's going to torture her in hell forever and take pleasure just because she didn't believe in Jesus. No, that's not exactly the way it works out. She's not being tortured. She'd be punished, not just because she didn't believe, but because she did things wrong. God would rather that she did things right. But that's the facts. This is the problem with emerging thinking. It often sacrifices the truth to be nice to people, to tell them what they want to hear. And again, as J.P. Moreland said, who will be my guest in the next hour, this is the cure that kills the patient. Well, that's Chuck Smith, Jr., book Frequently Avoided Questions. Maybe if I read more, I'd like more. But again, I want to emphasize there are things in here I did like insofar as he put his finger on a problem, and he did so even in the illustration I offered. But he gives the wrong answer, and so he doesn't help. All right, time to go to the phones, and this is Dieter in Santa Monica, California. Did I pronounce that first name right?
Yes.
That's a German name, isn't it?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Dieter, glad to have you on board.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to you, and it just seems kind of like it seems pretty mythological what you're saying.
Okay, what I said?
Well, I mean, dudes don't walk on water then rise from the dead. I mean, you just don't see it happening.
That's right. You
so
don't see that
like
happening.
It's all a myth. I mean, you hear stories all the time from back there in the olden times about stuff like that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't understand why you can believe something like that.
Well, I have no good reason not to believe it. The reason that you offered, by the way, that doesn't establish it, but I'm just starting making my case here. Just because, as you said, you don't see dudes doing that all the time, doesn't mean that those things don't happen. You know, I saw a guy last night skate in the Olympics and set an Olympic record. Well, that doesn't happen all the time, but it did happen.
But it happens every year or every
No, they don't set Olympic records every year. The point I'm making is just because an event may be extraordinary or rare doesn't mean it can't happen. Now, I think it's legitimate for someone to say, you know, I'm not obliged to believe something unusual unless I have good reasons to believe that it actually took place. And that's fully legitimate. I presume when you say that this sounds like myth, you mean that it sounds like somebody made the story up.
Well, it sounds like somebody made a story up possibly to teach a lesson like they do a lot of those myths or fairy tales.
Right, right.
You want to teach a lesson, so you make a story up or I mean, there's not a lot of evidence Jesus was around. I mean, you might have had somebody mention something about him, but you got people mentioning him.
Dieter, I'm sorry for breaking in here, but have you ever studied this issue at all? This on the issue that you just mentioned, there's not very much evidence that Jesus was even around. Did you hear someone say this, or did
you personally study the
question?
You know, they've got websites to talk about, and they talk
sure,
about
okay. Well, I'll tell you something.
Yeah, but I mean, what was that book we were talking about, the history of...
Let me ask you a question. Did you ever hear of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's evidence. Now, it may not be compelling to you, but that qualifies as evidence because these are ancient manuscripts that were circulating in the first and second centuries and beyond that describes the particulars of a life of a man from Jesus, named Jesus from Nazareth. Okay, now this is evidence.
Well,
and in fact,
I mean, it's just stories, though. I mean, it's not like anything necessarily real.
Well, that's the question.
I mean, it's, you know, people, I mean, there were a lot of stories going around, and you know, if you watch that thing on PBS over Christmas.
I understand how PBS does their job, does their work, and the way they and the kind of academics that they draw from. Okay, to say that they're just stories is a it ought to be a conclusion and not the way you start out. What's at stake here, what's in question, is whether or not it's just a story or whether or not it actually is an historical event. And if you want to find out whether those accounts are sound or accurate or not, you have to ask different questions. You can't just ask the question, is it amazing? Does it happen every day? And then if you say it is amazing and those kinds of things don't happen every day, therefore this is false, then you haven't done a sound job of reasoning about those events. You have to disqualify them for different reasons, because all historical events are unique in a certain sense.
Well, yeah, but I mean, when you're talking about history, I mean, it's like...
That's precisely my point. When you're talking about history, you don't dismiss things because you don't like them. You have to look at the evidence for those particular
things. Well, yeah, the evidence, and it seems kind of bizarre, and then...
Okay, wait a minute. What would be the evidence that's bizarre?
Hang on just a second. I missed my point.
Okay, sorry.
It sounds kind of bizarre, and then you hear these scholars, you know, from Harvard or, you know, wherever they are, Catholic University or wherever they are, and they'll talk about how, well, this is how the Gospels were put together, and people drew from this and that, and it just seems, well, okay, so they took the stories, and they probably embellished them a little to make a point, and so it just comes out kind of, well, okay, so this is what happened, but, I mean, it's not, like, really true.
Okay, well, let me offer a couple of pieces of evidence here, all right? Just a couple of pieces of evidence. First of all, the Apostle Paul is an historical figure. This is not disputed by any historian, okay? It is also not disputed that he died in 64 AD under the Neronian persecution. It is also not disputed that he wrote the book of 1 Corinthians in the New Testament, and he wrote the book of Romans, okay? Now, if he dies in 64, you follow me so far?
Yeah, following.
If he dies in 64, and Jesus was allegedly crucified in 33, that's 30 years difference from the time that Paul died, okay? Now, he died in 64, but by his own testimony, Romans was actually written quite a bit earlier. He has been testifying up until that time that Jesus has risen from the dead. That's called a high Christology. In other words, this isn't something that just got invented in the second, third century, but there was a very high view of Jesus, the Son of God, risen from the dead within 15 to 20 years, quantifiable. In other words, we can measure this written 15 to 20 years after Jesus himself allegedly lived. Okay, this isn't enough time for mythology to develop. In fact,
why not?
Because people who study mythology and study the development of these things track how long it takes to develop these things from fiction into a myth that's widespread. Let me give you one of the reasons. One of the reasons is you got too many people around that know the facts of the matter that can testify to the facts that these things are false when people are making up stories about Jesus in this case.
Well, wouldn't it be possible that people were around and they could testify those things were false, but, I mean, we don't have necessarily record of it?
Yeah, that's possible. Wouldn't it be possible that they weren't false, but he was telling the truth?
I guess that's another possibility, too.
Okay, good. Now, so we have two possibilities. The question is, which ones is best evidenced by the facts? Now, you can go to the four Gospels. Those are evidence from that time. You can go to the writings of Peter and John. These are also manuscript evidence from the time. You can also go to the Talmud that talks about Jesus, and they say that he was a worker of sorceries, and this is why he was executed. This is historical information. You can go to Josephus, who wrote at the end of the first century. He was a Jew who wrote the history of the Jews and talks about first century Judaism, and he mentions Jesus in there twice, and not only does he mention Jesus twice, but you have him mentioning other members of the apostolic band, James, for example, and specifically how he was executed. So you have, then you also have Tacitus, you have Pliny the Younger, and you have a number of different references in the early period there from documents that are, you might call, secular, like Josephus, that bear testimony and dovetail in with what those four accounts of Jesus' life actually say.
Weren't they written a lot later, though? I mean, so weren't they just kind of basing on what people told them?
Well, that's a claim that people make. That the problem is that when you actually look at the documents themselves, it doesn't work out this way. Do you remember I mentioned that Paul died in 64, okay? Right. And he was in prison in 62, in his first imprisonment, when the account in the New Testament called the Book of Acts comes to a close, that is an account of the early church and the life of Paul. He's in prison in 62. And so the guy who wrote the Book of Acts also wrote the Gospel of Luke. This is also undisputed, okay? Now, Luke then, the Gospel, the account of Jesus' life, must have been written before the book of Acts, which ends in 62. So the Gospel of Luke has to be written sometime in the late 50s. No scholar thinks that Luke is the first Gospel. The battle between the scholars is whether Mark's Gospel or Matthew's Gospel was first. And there's some question about that, but both of them have to come before Luke. That means if Luke writes in the late 50s, sometime in the mid-50s or even early 50s, you have Gospels, full Gospels of Jesus' life circulating. That's within 20 years of the events themselves. From an historical perspective, this is unbelievable.
Couple of points, though. One, most of the scholars I've heard say that, and like I think I even took a class in college or something that talked about this, that the stuff was written like after 70.
Right. And what happened in 70?
The Matthew, Mark, Luke
right.
guys.
Okay. What are the? Here's the. We have a tactic. We teach a standard reason called Rhodes Scholar, and the tactic it goes like this: when a scholar tells you something is so, you can't just stop there. You've got to ask, because people have different opinions, you've got to ask the scholar not just what he thinks, but why he thinks it's that way. So you need to know what are the reasons why he holds to they hold to them being written after 70. Now, what I did is I gave you my reasons. So I gave you an argument, Dieter. I didn't just assert that it was the case. I gave you very good reasons that are tied to known facts of history. Now, I'd want to know what they have to say to my argument. One other thought, and then I'm going to have to go because we had a break here, but it'll give you something to think about. Something happened in 70 AD. Do you know what it was? Jerusalem was destroyed.
Okay.
Now, Luke puts a prophecy in Jesus' mouth that Jerusalem would be destroyed. Do you think if whoever wrote Luke is writing after 70 and made up the prophecy, Jerusalem having been destroyed might be a good thing he should add in there? Jesus said it would be destroyed, and by the way, it has been.
Well, it depends on what his purpose of his writing. He's trying to make a literary form or something.
Well, the point is that if this was such a big deal that Jerusalem was destroyed, that if it had been destroyed before the writings of the Gospels, every single Gospel writer would have mentioned it. That's the point. Since it's not mentioned, this is very powerful evidence that they were written early. Now, I've just given you a couple things, Dieter, to think about. I'm going to have to move on. I'm sorry, we can't talk more about this,
Well, this is good stuff.
Pardon me?
This is good stuff, yeah.
Good.
I've got other questions, but okay.
Okay, let me just recommend two books for you. Jesus Under Fire. J.P. Moreland, who will be my guest next hour, is one of the authors there. And then there's just a simple book called The Historical Jesus by Blomberg, Blomberg. But I will tell you, just as one friend to another, Dieter, don't go around saying that there's no evidence that Jesus ever existed or very little. There is not a historian in the world that says that. Now, there's different debates about who he was and what he did, but no historian says he didn't exist. The evidence is too overwhelming for his existence, okay? Good talking to you. Thank you for your call. More coming up here on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series in Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting SCR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Greg Kokel back with you here, giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every Sunday, 3 to 5, when I'm in town, which will be a lot coming up this spring, I think. 1-800-227-5278. Back to the phones, and here in Japan, calling from the island of Japan. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Oh, is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, hello, Greg.
Glad you called.
It's been a while.
Yes, it has. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I have a quick question. I recently had a discussion with an old friend who happened to hold a strong view regarding Christian behavior when it comes to leisure. And basically what he said was we Christians should be careful how we spend our free time. That is, we should always do what glorifies God when it comes to that. And according to his view, we should avoid listening, you know, secular music, watch movies, TV, and so on, and entirely concentrate on what glorifies God. So,
well, doesn't that kind of presume that there's nothing in secular culture that could bring any glory to God? Doesn't that kind of presume that?
And then he says, you know, only listening gospel would be kind of the only solution for music lovers. And then he mentioned,
by the way, it also presumes that Christian music always glorifies God too. So that's another questionable presupposition.
And then he said, knowing distinction between righteousness and holiness would somehow open an eye to that, and which was kind of a puzzling statement to me, you know, to hear to begin with, and I didn't know where to start.
Yeah, well, Steve, I don't know the distinction there when he talks about righteousness versus holiness. Maybe you could ask him, and he'd explain it a little bit more. But
we don't have time. Chat conversations. So
yeah, okay. Well,
I don't have time to.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Let me respond to the first point, though, and that is, do we need to be careful in how we use our time? Sure. Do we need to live our lives, even in our leisure time, in a way that glorifies God? Sure. No one takes exception with that. The question then becomes, what is the appropriate way to fulfill those obligations? And he's suggesting that we should – then he's got a bunch of nevers. Never listen to secular music, never watch secular programming or TV or whatever. And
yeah, no movies at all.
And we should be listening to gospel. Now, I mentioned that it presumes a couple of things. It presumes that if our goal is to be careful how we use our time and to glorify God in all things, that we can never glorify God by looking at anything secular, and that we are always glorifying God when we look at religious programming. Both of those statements are suspect in my mind. There have been many times that I have been deeply touched, shall we say spiritually, by watching something secular. In fact, I saw a movie on an airplane going over to Delaware last week. It was a Robert Redford movie entitled An Unfinished Life. And the movie is built around the death of a young man, Robert Redford's son, and they had on his tombstone An Unfinished Life. Now, I thought that was a clever concept just to begin with, An Unfinished Life, but it talked about how his unwillingness to forgive, even when he was in need of forgiveness himself, was tearing him up and destroying his life. And so it wasn't just the son's life that was unfinished, the one that died an untimely death. It was his life that was unfinished because he had not come to grips with the issue of forgiveness. Now, this was a very touching film for me. There is nothing in this overtly that was religious, but the themes were religiously sound or spiritually sound, even though there was a couple of lines in there attacking people who were hawking God door to door. You know, so the filmmaker wasn't trying to promote any religion, but he really touched in something true. Now, I think it is very possible, in fact, quite probable, given that human beings are made in the image of God, that people who are not believers not only can be in touch with deep truths, but can express those truths in art. And movies would be an example of that. Do we have to be careful? I'd say yes, we do. By the way, in that book that I was just critiquing, Frequently Avoided Questions by Chuck Smith Jr., he talks about something about movies. in one of these chapters, oh, does God speak outside the Bible? And there he actually makes a very legitimate point, I think, that when you watch movies sometimes done by a secularist, you can get more edified because of the power of the way that this message is communicated, the power of the medium, than if you went and heard a sermon that was poorly delivered. I think that's true. And that's why I'm not willing to rule out as a waste of time and not glorifying God all secular forms of art.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
That's all right.
Matrix kind of is a good example of that.
Who is that?
Matrix movie, Matrix.
Oh, yeah. Well, there it...
I don't know. I mean, it reflects kind of, on believers and unbelievers' side.
There are a lot of things that people have chosen to capitalize on in those movies that and use them as a means to communicate the gospel. It also does raise a question that is kind of a timely question for the postmodern era. What is truth and what is reality? And so these are important questions to be discussed. So Paul read secular literature. I know he did because in Acts chapter 19, I think it was, or maybe 18, he quotes from secular literature. So if Paul was familiar with secular literature well enough that he could quote by memory from it, then it seems to me a ban on all secular things is probably a mistake. Now, do we have to be careful? Yes, we do. And I'm not saying that I've always made all the right decisions in this regard, but certainly we need to be careful and we need to be circumspect. I am not at all convinced that just limiting your viewing to Christian gospel kinds of things is a good idea. There are some Christian stations here in the States. I don't know if you've seen them, Steve, if you've ever been here from Japan, but I'll tell you what, most of what I see on there is absolute garbage, though it goes under the heading of Christian and gospel. So I don't think that your friend's advice taken as a whole is good advice. All right?
And what about music, secular music? Would that be all right to...
Well, I was listening to... Gordon Lightfoot the other day in a song called the Canadian Railroad Trilogy. Since 2 weeks ago, I was in Canada, and I was moved again almost to tears by this wonderful song because it is a description of what man, as I would read it now, made in the image of God, is able to accomplish, say, given a creation mandate of being fruitful and multiplying, subduing the earth, going out into the wilderness and making it habitable. In this case, it was an ode to those men who had given their lives and their sweat and toil and blood to make a coast-to-coast railway in the country of Canada. And it's a wonderfully done by a man who knows how to write this kind of music, and it's quite touching. And so... I'm not against all secular music. One of my favorites of all time is the old music by Simon and Garfunkel. They were wonderful lyricists, and I think they really, really were able to touch things that were true as far as they went. And there is a song called Old Friends that has I've reflected on many times. I know it by heart. And in this, it talks about aging and growing old and the tragedy of growing older. And that reminds me to number my days. So again, on this point, I wouldn't agree with him either. Stephen, I got to run. I thank you for your call from Japan. We've got to get another call in before we finish this hour. That would be Kevin. Let me find the line there. Kevin in Colorado. Kev, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm kind of reeling from the call from Dieter. I thought that was just a great call. I'm really excited
for him
and for the... for the journey he's going to be going on.
Well, thank you. And he was very cooperative in our discussion, but you can see how he was a little excited and he started making kinds of statements that, you know, a lot of people make. But, you know, we need to go back and let's just walk through this a little bit and take a look and see what we're saying and what the evidence is. So, good. Thank you.
Right,
What's on your mind, Kev?
I've been reading and leading a group of people through a book called Hard to Believe by John MacArthur.
Yes.
And sort of getting me into wrestling more with the concepts of election and free will and predestination and
right. All
that.
Hard issues,
and,
by the way.
Yeah, I think there's I've made some good progress on it. So I guess what I'm wondering about is as a person from the point of view of free will, I tend to see grace as I'm very thankful for God's grace in the sense that He created a gift for me. He offers it to me, and I'm allowed to choose it if I want it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thankful for that. Now, when I take the point of view of a Calvinist, if I understand this at all, and this is what I want to get your opinion on,
mm-hmm.
I see it a little bit differently. I'm still thankful for the gift of Jesus' death and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But grace seems to me, in that point of view, is more like God demonstrated his grace to me by the fact that he elected me into the group to begin with.
Yeah, and then he forgave you of your crimes, right?
Right.
Yeah, so
instead of being thankful for a gift that I'm getting and that I choose to receive, I'm more thankful that for something that happened even before that, in a sense.
Right. It
does to be in the group.
Right. Now, are you saying that you're more thankful as a from the Calvinist perspective or less?
Yeah, I guess I'm more like, whew, boy, that was a close one.
Yeah, well, that's the way I feel, too. Now, I hold the views I hold with regards to that issue. I am Calvinist with regards to salvation, and
right.
because I think the Bible teaches this, it does create some philosophic problems, and but a lot hinges on the nature of what free will is. Amounts to, and how do you cash that out? There are a couple of different views on that, and we don't have time to go into detail on that. But the big issue, in my view, has to do with fallenness. How fallen are we? And my take on the scriptures is we're pretty much out of there. I mean, we are without hope and without God in the world, and we are not running towards God. We are running from him. Frankly, I think even all Arminians have to agree that that's the case, at least from the get-go. The question is, how much grace does God give, and what is the nature of the grace that God gives to turn rebels towards him? And I think that when God gives grace, it is thorough and complete. It brings you all the way where those, and I'm not trying to caricature their view, but I think it's something along this line, who are Arminian, hold that God gives grace to the point of kind of evening out some of the effects of the fall so that you can make a libertarian free decision, either for or against God, and therefore God's grace is for your sins, but the decision is yours to make, and God gives you just enough grace to so that you can then have kind of, you can be the thing in the balance. Whereas a Calvinist, I would hold that God's grace doesn't work that way. It's kind of an all or nothing kind of thing when it comes to the salvation question.
Right.
And that I am his because he chose me and not because he freed me up enough to choose him because I thought it was the best. That's the best I can do in a minute and a half on that one. But I do feel like you, though I can understand how some of my Arminian friends would feel differently, that there is more reason to thank God in from this perspective, because I've been rescued from myself completely. And, whew, that's a close one. I feel the same way. Hour number two coming up in just a second. My guest, Dr. J.P. Moreland. Stay with us.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
All right, friends, hour number two here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host. And we're going to be chatting with one of my most favorite people here about something you might be surprised to hear. He is the director of the Influential Master's Program of Philosophy, Religion, and Ethics at Talbot School of Theology, actually somebody that I have been studying under after a fashion for years, and in fact many of you have done that as well, that is, that you've been reading his books, of which there are many. Scaling the Secular City goes all the way back, Immortality, The Other Side of Death, The Life and Death Debate. I'm reading through all the titles here because we're having a hard time getting them on the phone right now. Does God Exist? The Great Debate with Kai Nielsen. Christianity and the Nature of Science. Love Your God with All Your Mind, Body, and Soul. And on and on and on. And the phone's still ringing. Well, we don't have JP on board yet, so we're going to keep trying. But he has spoken recently about some pretty remarkable things that are happening in countries outside of the United States about the movement of the Spirit, particularly in Muslim countries, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about that. But until we can get him on the air, we're going to talk about something else. Let me just give you the numbers then in case this doesn't work out. You can get in the queue, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150. 1-800-227-5278. Line's wide open there. I was surprised to see on the front page of the LA Times, column one, this would be like human interest stuff off to the left. If you read the LA Times, you know what I'm talking about. If you do, I feel sorry for you. It's one of the most painful newspapers to read. But here's a piece on creationism. Of course, this has been in the news because of the was that Dover, Delaware? That was the Dover, Delaware case. That's where I was at last weekend. Huh, I didn't even realize that. But the Dover, Delaware case about intelligent design and creationism and schools and all of that. So here is a piece that focuses on one of the most well-known creationists, Ken Ham, and his organization, Answers in Genesis. I don't see the URL here, but they probably give it somewhere. But Ken's pretty well-known. He's a young earth creationist, and he goes around the country giving conferences and seminars. Do we get JP or no? Not yet? Okay. And promoting creationism, particularly the young earth variety, with a passion and with a fury, over and against not only Darwinism, but any old earth cosmology. And that's created a little bit of friction with other Christians, but I'm glad he's out there doing the job he's doing because he's training a lot of people. But sometimes I do get concerned about the way that people are learning to defend the truth. Since this is my business, this is what I do for a living, this is my role in the body of Christ to train people to navigate more successfully here. Since this is the goal of Stand to Reason, to train people to be better, to train Christians to be better thinkers, I am not only on the lookout for things that non-Christians say and the way they deal with things, like Dieter in the Last Hour and the historicity of the Gospels, for example, mistakes they make, but also missteps that Christians make as well as they try to defend what we both believe in. If I believe in a creationism of some sort, God created, intelligent design, Genesis, not Darwinian evolution, then you know, we're on the same page there. We're promoting the same deal. Yet there may be ways that people who I agree with in the ultimate, that is their final point, but I don't like the way they got there because I don't think it's a good way to get there. I don't think it's a sound way to get there. And I did see something in this article on Ken Ham that's like this. In fact, I've heard this point frequently. And people have made it here on this show, and I think this is, as it turns out, a non-Christian way of defending your view on something. Let me just read what the LA Times says. It's describing an event that Ken Ham is teaching at. Evangelist Ken Ham, this is in Wayne, New Jersey. Evangelist, oh, by the way, notice how they listed Evangelist Ken Ham. He's not a scientist. He's not an educator. He's an evangelist. Yeah, that's dirty pool as far as I'm concerned. Maybe that's a way of describing him, but I don't think. Oh, it's Dover, Pennsylvania. Not Dover, New Jersey. Delaware. Okay, never mind. I wasn't in the town where that happened. In any event, Ken Ham smiled at his 2,300 elementary students packed into pews, their faces rapt. The description from the LA Times writer Stephanie Simon. With dinosaur puppets and silly cartoons, he was training them to reject much of geology, paleontology, and evolutionary biology as a sinister tangle of lies. Now, I'm not reading it for this point, but this is why I don't like the LA Times. Okay, it's got a byline. Stephanie Simon, Times staff writer. But it's a front page piece. It's supposed to be news, not an editorial. So why do we get this mischaracterization, evangelist? silly cartoons, training them to reject geology, paleontology, and evolutionary biology as sinister tangles of lies. Oh, maybe that's what he said, but she didn't quote him. This is Stephanie speaking. I digress. Boys and girls, Ham said, if a teacher so much as mentions evolution or the Big Bang or an era when dinosaurs ruled the earth, you put your hand up and you say, let me find it. Excuse me, were you there? Can you remember that? The children roared their assent. Sometimes people will answer no, but you weren't there either, Ham told them. And then you say, no, I wasn't, but I know someone who was. And I have this book about the history of the world, and he waved the Bible in the air. Now, I am concerned that that is not a good way to defend one's point, but I'll have to wait for a little bit and maybe until the next show to tell you why, because we've got my guest J.P. Moreland on the air here, and Jay has been probably the biggest influence in my life as a thinking Christian. Jay, thank you for taking some time to join us this afternoon.
Oh, Greg, it's an honor. It's good to be with you, my friend.
I was just going through your pedigree here, and I was running out of books. I actually read about 15, and then when we weren't able to get you right away on the line, so I had to go to another topic. But I probably could have just kept reading, you know, because I think you probably got about 40 or 45 titles of that you were involved in one way or another. But of course, you're a friend of this program. You're a friend to me personally. You're a friend to Stand to Reason. You've had a tremendous influence on my life and on so many others that listen to this show and people I run into. But, you know, people every once in a while will tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, I've heard some strange things about Dr. Moreland. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, he's so brilliant. He's got all these great teachings. But then he starts talking about, like, miracles happening overseas and visions and all kinds of ways the Holy – and it just seems to be so inconsistent. Now, this mystifies me, Jay, because I don't see any inconsistency at all between being intellectually sharp and having a confidence that God can work miraculously. But you have mentioned this in many of your talks, and I thought maybe we'd talk for a little bit here and have you bring our audience up to speed on some of the things that you're aware of are going on around the world, particularly as kind of a backdrop to maybe some of the depression or frustration Christians are feeling with lack of response of this in this country. And when we were on our cruise together in August, we were on a panel together, and a woman asked the question, boy, what do we do? It's just so hard because people aren't listening, and it just seems like we're losing. And your comment was, maybe it looks like we're losing here for the moment, but that's not true everywhere else. So why don't you pick it up from there and tell us what's going on?
Yeah, Greg, by the way, I may have influenced you, but you've influenced me greatly. I mean, your ministry over the last 10 years has just been overwhelming, and I have derived constant strength and nourishment from Stand to Reason, and I recommend your website to people all the time.
Oh, that's great.
And it's just it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
Well, I'm very flattered to hear you say that, Jay. Thank you.
There's a book that was published a while back by Philip Jenkins, and Jenkins is a distinguished professor of history at Penn State University. So he's not a rabid charismatic or some wild-eyed televangelist.
Mm-hmm.
The book he published was on global Christianity with Oxford University Press. And here's what Jenkins said. He said, by far the single biggest news story of the 20th century is not the rise and fall of communism. It is not the emergence of feminism or other isms like that. But it is the spread of evangelical Christianity around the world in the 20th century. And he went on to say that the biggest explosion of any kind of movement in history has been the explosion of the church in the latter part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I have talked to missions leaders around the country, including some of the professors at Biola University's PhD program in intercultural studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, Greg, that person after person after person is making the same claim. There is a book by Jim Rutz. Jim Rutz writes a weekly column for the worldnewsdaily.net, and that's a major website.
Is it R-U-T-Z?
Website.
R-U-T-Z?
Say it again?
How do you spell his last name?
R-U-T-Z, yeah.
Okay.
I've actually met with Jim. But he has done research, highly documented research, and let me give you some statistics here. Around 1970, missiologists were able to identify around 71 million believers worldwide that they call radical Christians. These would be Christians that are parts of fellowships aggressively spreading the gospel in their area. Now, that was 70, it was, I think, 77 million believers.
Mm-hmm.
As of the year 2000, that had grown to 707 million Christians.
Wow.
That's 11% of the world's population.
Right.
Around 1980, there were two white Christians to every one non-white Christian. By the year 2000, that statistic had changed to where there were something like four to one and non-white to white, and that's going to be something like 10 to 1 by the year 2010 to 2015. In the year 2000, I think it was, it might have been 1998, there were a group of church planters in South America that met, and they set a goal of planting 500,000 churches in the next 10 years. And by the year 2006, they had already reached the goal, and they had to establish a new objective.
Is this in South America or worldwide?
Yeah. All over. This was just a group of countries in South America.
Mm-hmm.
The spread of the kingdom of God, by the way, the statistics are that if things continue the way they've been going since 1970, by the year 2030, every person on the face of the earth is going to be a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I know that's not going to happen,
right.
And the statisticians know that's not going to happen.
But it gives us a sense of the momentum.
To illustrate the exponential explosion of the Christian faith all over the world, and it is the most undercovered news story in the latter part of the 20th century. It is overwhelming, Greg,
now,
what's happening.
Jay, do you think this is because I know that I served in Thailand in 1982, and when I came back as a missionary there, and when I came back, I went to the U.S. Center for World Mission. I took their program there that they were really developing, reaching the unreached peoples, and there was a whole strategy there that you're familiar with, the worldwide Christian movement, and especially targeting unreached peoples. So there was a growing interest in the they call it 2040 window or whatever, the Muslim nations, and so there was this shift. Now we're in a third wave kind of thing. Now is it part of your assessment that this is fruit of that focus coming out of the 80s and the 90s there, and this is bearing fruit and getting momentum, or is there are other things that are built into this?
I think that's had something to do with it, but this is so explosive that I think it is merely an outbreak of the power of the kingdom worldwide.
Just a sovereign work of God.
Clint Arnold, who's a professor at Talbot Seminary, very well-regarded professor, taught a course last summer at Columbia International University in South Carolina with about 20 missionaries that were off the field to take some summer refresher courses.
Mm-hmm.
He asked these 20 missionaries if they which ones of them were seeing miracles and signs and wonders alike under biblical times.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of them said that the growth of the church in their part of the world was substantially due to an outbreak of miraculous healings, demonic deliverances, and an outbreak of the power of the kingdom.
Mm.
Doug Hayward at Biola University, who teaches, he's a professor of cultural anthropology, he sends doctoral students to different parts of the world to do research in the summertime. And I saw a notebook that he had collected from some of these doctoral students that had gone to India. They had interviewed a whole host of pastors that are Indian pastors
mm-hmm.
about the growth of the church in India and why it was growing. As I read this, I just fell to my knees. It is due to the fact that the name of Jesus is bringing demonic deliverance from people. There are demonic encounters
mm-hmm.
with Hindu religions. And it isn't the name of Buddha. It isn't the name of Muhammad. Mm-hmm. In the name of Jesus, people are being delivered from demons. They're being healed. The lame are walking.
Mm-hmm.
Blind people are having sight restored to them. And this was the testimony of pastors that were interviewed by the doctoral students in India. This is firsthand stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Last summer, the Washington Post did a featured story on the church in China. Now, I don't have to tell your listeners that the Washington Post is not a mimeographed production from Sugar Creek Bible College, right?
Right?
The Washington Post is a secular media outlet. And they said in this article, I've got it in my office, that the largest explosion of any people movement in China is the underground church. It is far larger now than the Communist Party in China. This article went on to say that the main reason that the underground church is exploding in China, are you ready for this, are healings and miracles. And they cited an example of a young lady who came down with a deathly virus. She went into a hospital. The doctors had not seen this virus, and she was dying. They had her on an oxygen mask, and she was wasting away. The Post goes on to say that a local pastor came in, and in the presence of her extended family, which was all Buddhists, laid hands on this young lady, and she was instantly, miraculously healed. Mm-hmm. And her entire extended family was converted mm-hmm. on the spot to Christ. Now, this kind of thing is happening, and it's starting to be recorded by credible journalists and by credible sources.
I'm just out of curiosity.
It's got a lot to do with what's going on.
JP, how did the Post handle this? It's hard for me to imagine that they did a straight reporting job on it, partly because I was just reading this piece from the LA Times that was so lopsided in the way it was handled. What did the Post make of this? Did you have any sense of that as you read it?
Yeah, it basically recorded it as, I mean, this healing of this lady was an undisputed fact. Hmm. That happened in the hospital.
Yeah.
So there was they just said this is something that's happening in China, and mm-hmm. it was kind of like a factual report. They didn't editorialize on it.
Mm-hmm. We have to go to break, Jay. When I come back, I want to talk to you about the Muslim conversions.
Yeah.
This is especially a concern to me, and we had some firsthand contact with some people of this that had radical experiences. My guest, J.P. Moreland, we're talking about not philosophy, not apologetics per se. We're talking about the miraculous move of the Holy Spirit around the world and how Jay has been watching if the facts pile up on this, and we're just knocking it around a little bit for your edification, encouragement, and your challenge. We'll be back with more of J.P. Moreland in just a moment right here on Stand to Reason.
Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will emcee all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul exhorted him in 2 Timothy 2:14 to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason chose it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry as well. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kokel with you here on Stand to Reason. And so glad you've joined me with my guest, Dr. J.P. Moreland. By the way, I'll be at Biola tomorrow night, 7:30, for their Defending the Faith kickoff lecture. I'll be doing a talk called Truth is a Strange Sort of Fiction. And I'll be talking about understanding the emerging culture and the emerging church that responds and reacts and is adapting in some ways to that culture. Jay, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that before our hour is done here. Yeah, but
sure, you bet.
Because I closed that quote, that talk with a quote for, that from your talk at ETS a year and a half ago. But something else is on our minds here today, and that is, though here in this country, you know, we're kind of hunkering down for this battle here, and it's hard for people that want to live for Christ, especially in the face of a postmodern culture, and communicate their faith. And it's like the rug is ideologically, philosophically, epistemologically being pulled out from underneath us. We can't even get started here. Yet you're saying in other parts of the world, there is a geometric wave of conversions that, to a large degree, is connected to a powerful, miraculous display of the Holy Spirit who just shows up. It isn't even somebody's strategy.
That's right.
It's just the Holy Spirit. And it's not only in China, as you mentioned, and in the Philippines and in South America, but also the Muslim world is being influenced or being reached after fashion in this way, too. Yeah. Tell me about it.
More Muslims have come to Christ in the last 10 years than in the last 1,500. I was talking to Dallas Willard a year ago, and Dallas had just been in contact with five missions organizations. Dallas Willard teaches at University of California.
Right.
He's a philosophy professor. I know you know that.
Right.
And Dallas had just been in contact with five missions agencies that work with Muslims. And these range from charismatic to just traditional, you know, Baptist and evangelical mission agencies. Every single one of them reported that there has been an outbreak of Jesus appearing to Muslims in dreams, or angels appearing to Muslims, saying that Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, and they are to seek him. And this is consistent with reports that I'm hearing from missionaries to Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Eshelman, who is in charge of the Jesus film, is widely respected in the evangelical community. He's very much like a Billy Graham figure. He's very credible. He's a statesman for us.
Mm-hmm.
In the Jesus film newsletter, I just got a copy of the most recent newsletter, and in the Jesus film newsletter, Paul Eshelman is saying that something like 90% of the converts to Christianity get their first inkling of the gospel message through a visitation of the Lord Jesus or an angel.
Mm-hmm.
And he cites an example of where the Jesus film crew was in a very dangerous Muslim area, and they had the car filled with gospel tracks and a 12-millimeter projector to show the Jesus film. Well, a police officer pulls them over to the side of the road. And he says, I want you to take this. There was a distinguished Muslim imam or teacher there, and they said, the police officer said, I want you to take this Muslim teacher to a site that he needs to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he gets in the car, and they're scared to death. And he looks at them and says, are you the people telling people about God? And the film crew looks at each other and says, what are we going to do now? And they gulped and said, well, yes, we are.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I had a dream last night that if I would come to this spot in the road at this particular hour of the day today, that I would come across people who would tell me about God. Will you tell me about God?
Mm.
And they led this Muslim teacher to Christ in the car on the spot.
Hmm.
This kind of thing is happening all over the Muslim world. There's another account where the Jesus film crew was showing the Jesus film to a remote village of about 250 Muslims. They got into the film about 5 minutes, and everyone in the village began to wail and weep uncontrollably. They had to stop the film. They asked them, is this offensive to you? Why are you weeping? And one man said, the man in that film was in our town for the last 2 days walking around and talking to people before you got here.
Hmm.
And what had happened, I believe, is that the Lord Jesus had taken on a form of the man in the film and prepared these people to hear the gospel.
You know, I've heard a similar kind of thing. Let me, before I get into my little story here, just for my listeners' sake, you know, people know that you and I have a little different idea of understandings about how the Holy Spirit works in our lives and sanctification and guidance and things like that.
Yeah.
But these things that you're describing here are clearly biblical motifs.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm completely on board with the legitimacy of this kind of thing. There's no reason why anybody, I think, should doubt that God would appear in these kinds of ways. And
this is a harvest, Greg. You're right. And just to illustrate this one step further, I'm a very close friend of a Christian therapist who does work with MAF,
Missionary Aviation Fellowship.
That's right. And I had told him about some of these stories. It just so happened that the next day, he was going to be doing some counseling with a missionary from Indonesia that had come off the field for furlough. And he works with Muslims. And so my friend, Dr. Bill Roth, said to this missionary, "Are you seeing any of this kind of stuff in where you're working?" Well, he got a big grin on his "Are you hearing about it?" he said. And he got a grin on his face and said, "Hearing about it? I'm seeing it in my own ministry." He said, for example, 2 weeks ago, I was in the marketplace, had a blue jacket on, and a Muslim walks up to me out of nowhere and says, "Will you tell me about God?" And he said, "I had a dream last night. I saw your face, and I saw the jacket that you have on, and I was told in the dream that if I saw a man that looked like you today with a blue jacket on in the marketplace, that you would tell me about God." And this missionary led this man to Christ right there in the marketplace. Now, this is a missionary he's not trying to get attention from this group.
Right.
He wasn't raising support. In fact, he didn't even bring the subject up. My friend just asked him about this sort of thing, and he had a fresh story 2 weeks before then of something that had happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are too many reports for this to all be a bunch of hoopla.
Right.
And something weird, and by weird I mean
unique.
Another realm here.
Yeah, right.
The kingdom is happening,
yeah.
And I think Christians should be so encouraged by this.
Well, I have to tell you, it's terribly, in the best sense of the word, encouraging to me because, I have to continually remind myself of the sovereignty of God when we're facing the kinds of things we're facing in this culture right now, and the emerging church movement inside the churches has raised deep concerns for you and I both and many others who are thoughtful about these issues, and because we're concerned about the church in this country and the gospel going out.
Absolutely.
And so it is, you know, it's easy to get a bad self-image kind of thing. It's an inferiority complex a little bit. And even though we know this is part of what your and my job entails in dealing with this, it is a real boost to me to hear these accounts. And not only just to hear them from you, but, you know, we have our ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, every fall over there the week before Thanksgiving around the country. We were in, where were we last time? Philadelphia area. And conjointly with that, we have Evangelical Philosophical Society,
right.
Which is part of the same enterprise, and we've been having an EPS conference in a local church for the last 4 years.
Right.
As you know, we both participated in that. This time, at the church there in the Valley Forge area, there was a young man that came up to us who was a former Muslim who has been living in the United States studying here, who actually was he was converted because of two things happening kind of at the same time. One is, he was talking to a Christian apologist, that is, some other Christian who understood apologetics.
Yes, yes.
And he could use the discipline that we both represent and talk to him. And it turns out that this Muslim was himself a Muslim apologist. He came from a sect of Muslims that were trained as apologists. His whole family's like this. And he said two things happened. First of all, he says, my apologetics were no match for his. That is, the kinds of evidence that he was able to bring were so paltry by comparison to the Christian. And he also was having dreams and visions with regards to Jesus about this. Now, this brings up a question. It was thrilling. I talked to him. And I think there were two different people at this conference that had something like that. But in any event, is it your understanding that these visions are and miraculous outpouring are kind of happening in isolation? Or do you see this conjunction of the supernatural movement of God with somebody there to bring the solid account of Jesus, the information that's sound?
The latter, though there is some of the former. For example, there are some occasions where an angel or in a vision, the entire gospel content will be communicated so that when missionaries get there, these people have already believed in Jesus, but they don't know much more about him.
Right, right.
But more often than not, what happens is they are told that Jesus is the truth, the way, the truth, and the life, and they are to seek him. And it's shortly thereafter that a mission team comes, and there are already folks there seeking Jesus. When they hear the full gospel, they're just like picking ripe fruit.
Yeah, they're just bumping the fruit. It falls into the basket. And this is helpful.
Can I give you one more example?
Sure. Yes.
Greg?
Yeah, go ahead.
At Biola University, about a year ago, maybe it was two now, we had a guy teaching a class on Muslim apologetics, how to do evangelism with Muslims. The second week of class, they were going to go to a Muslim area here in L.A. and go witnessing. They're getting ready to go out witnessing, and a man stands up in the class and says, "I want to become a Christian." Now, everybody at Biola is a believer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what had happened. During the Jan term, some Biola students had gone to Saudi Arabia on a short-term trip. Flying back on the airplane, one of them sat next to a Muslim businessman from Saudi Arabia coming to L.A. for about a month to do business. And they said to him, "Why don't you come to this class with me?" So he had sat in on the first week of class, and nobody knew that he wasn't. They thought he was a student. And
right.
The second week when they were going to go witnessing, he stands up, and he wants to get saved, and he does. And here's what he said. He said, I have been seeing Jesus in visions before I came here.
Mm.
And he begins to tell the class what he had been told in these visions. And, Greg, he cited gospel texts in the New Testament, and he had never read the New Testament. He'd never seen a New Testament.
Yeah.
And this was witnessed by people at Biola. I mean, this is not a made-up story. So
right.
I do think sometimes these people get the full deal, but more often than not, it is a work of the Spirit preparing hearts for people to hear the rest of the gospel and then even begin to get some New Testament literature so they can start growing.
Yeah, you know, I've talked about this. I just mentioned last hour a couple of times in the last few months. We have a standard talk. We call it the heathen and the unknown God. I used the word heathen before. It's politically incorrect, you know. But
the point
is the unevangelized. And it's a legitimate question. If Jesus is the only way, then what about the person who's never heard? And I spend a lot of time talking about that. But the way I end up cashing it out is that it's unthinkable to me. Like, I'm not an inclusivist. I'm not a pluralist, you know, where you got to believe in Jesus. That's the New Testament motif here. But it is unthinkable to me that God would begin a work in somebody's heart, touching them with revelation of some sort or touching their heart to turn to him and seek him and not give them the
Absolutely.
Information that's necessary for them to respond by faith and receive the gift of salvation that he offers. And I cite there's a lot of biblical examples. I mean, look at Cornelius. He was a God-fearer. He gave alms and everything, but he still needed the gospel and the Ethiopian eunuch. And there are a lot of biblical examples, but modern-day ones as well. And I cite some from Don Richardson's material. But
Yes. Here
you have things that are happening now with Muslims, which, I mean, this is – talk about timely. For people, I think, for understandable reasons, they're a little bit nervous about witnessing to Muslims.
Rightly so.
Yeah, and then to hear what God is doing in the lives of so many in a supernatural way. Yeah, it really is.
My view is, God obviously, his normal means of operating is to use a human evangelist as a part of the deal. But there have been times when out of his pure mercy and grace, he's actually communicated the message of his son to somebody in a dream.
Direct revelation.
That's not his normal method of operation.
Right.
But you're right. The deal is that God, if someone wants to know him, they're going to know him.
Mm-hmm.
God's not going to leave somebody in the lurch, and he's just too wonderful for that.
Yeah, and not only will he probably bring someone with the message, but if he doesn't, as you pointed out, and I've said this for years, I have no theological problem with God giving a direct revelation with this caveat that the revelation he's going to get, the God they discover will not be Buddha or Krishna or Allah or Zeus or Ahura Mazda. The God they discover will be the true God. That is Jesus himself. And this is exactly what's happening. We're not getting this kind of like generalized, pluralistic, there's some God.
Not.
It's the man.
In fact, Greg, you know, one of the reasons, there are so many reasons why I'm a Christian, but let me tell you one why I believe Christianity is true. The missionaries are reporting that in demonic encounters, the name of Jesus triumphs and has power over these demons, whereas the name of Buddha, these other names don't do anything.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not psychosomatic.
That in these other countries. Right. But there are overt demonic manifestations that are squelled and quieted and exorcised in the name of the Son of God, but not in these other names. Now, you explain that to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a power. I mean, that's another evidence.
Sure.
I mean, if Christianity's true, wouldn't you expect that the name of Jesus would have an authority mm-hmm. over the demonic, whereas the names of these other guys would not? And that's what we're finding happening. Mm-hmm. I just think these are incredible days.
Yeah, another account that I'd heard is similar to what you said earlier about people, Muslims, having these dreams, everyone in the village. But the Jesus they saw was, and this goes back to something you said earlier, was really the picture of Jesus that matched the actor's face in the movie, the Jesus film.
Yes.
So that when the film came right. around, they recognized this is the same one that I'd been dreaming about.
Absolutely.
And then the Jesus film had its impact. And,
absolutely.
Again, I wanted – that's important to emphasize, because I think that for a lot of reasons in the church, there is this movement towards, if not pluralism, certainly a kind of an inclusivism where, yeah, well, Jesus is our thing, but – you know, and maybe he's the only way, but you don't have to actually believe in him. There's a lot of good people elsewhere that are doing the best they can, and, you know, God's going to yeah. take care of them. Well, these accounts that you're sharing make it clear that God cares about the particulars.
Yeah.
And
he's making sure the particulars are
communicated.
Are part of the deal there.
That's right. Jay, can you stay with us for another 20 minutes?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that'll be great. Right. Okay, J.P. Moreland, my guest. We're talking about signs and wonders and evangelism. Here in the 21st century. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series and Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. The show is Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, giving you a piece of my mind today. As I usually do, Sundays 3 until 5. Tomorrow night, I'll be at Biola University talking about postmodernism. Truth is a Strange Sort of Fiction. That starts at 7:30 at Sutherland Hall. I'll be giving the same talk. A week later, that's next Sunday morning, 11 a.m., at the Aliso Creek Presbyterian Church in Laguna Niguel. Is that on our website, Melinda? Okay, so you can go to str.org and punch my face, and you'll get the skinny on that. Also, on the 25th, that will be next Saturday, I'll be at Lighthouse Bible Church in Simi Valley. I go there every year and do an all-day conference there, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. I'll be talking about science and faith. Are they compatible? I'll be talking about from truth to experience, tactics in defending the faith. So contact number there, 805, area code 522-4573. That's 522-4573. But all the information is on our website at str.org, and hope to see you at one of those events tomorrow night.
site next Sunday or Saturday for the all-day event in Simi Valley. Talking with J.P. Moreland here, a man who's had a tremendous influence on my life, and really is, I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to flatter you, you know, J.P., I just, you know, it's hard to quantify the impact that you've had, and it seems like every time I turn around as I'm listening to myself, I say, that sounds like J.P., but that's okay, because I think you really have been a help to so many people through Stand to Reason as well.
Well, and, we're on the same team. There's no doubt about that.
Well, the this issue, though, is a new area probably for a lot of people associated with Stand to Reason, signs and wonders. And I want to tie the two together here for a moment, get your opinion about this. And that is, and we've hinted at this already. Now, let me introduce it by saying something happened at church this morning. They're taking a collection of books to send to India. Now, they said, you know, we don't want all your theological tomes or your commentaries and stuff, your extra stuff. We want something sixth grade level and below. Now, I didn't get to talk to anybody and ask them why, and maybe they think this is the reading level. They're trying to make it simple on people, but, I mean, this is a former English colony, for goodness sake. These people speak English, and my concern is that there's kind of a dumbing down theologically
right. Of
this kind of thing, and this is always a concern, I think, appropriate concern when there are radical experiential manifestations of the Spirit. How do you keep things kind of pinned, tied down appropriately to truth
yep. And
doctrinal soundness? What are your thoughts on that?
When you look in the book of Acts, you will see that there were two things the church did to spread its message. One was the power of the kingdom in signs and wonders, and
right. The
other was intellectual persuasion.
Yeah.
And you it's a both and. And in fact, in the first three centuries of the church, you see the church fathers talking about the fact that healings and things of that sort were still happening, but they were also writing very precise theological treatises to the Roman officials
right. And
in the church and so on. It's a both and.
And dealing with Gnosticism and things like that.
Other parts of the world
right. Are
starving for theology and biblical study. Mm-hmm. These supernatural manifestations don't take the place of it. In fact, they're just entrances for us to then bring more.
Mm-hmm.
I have a former student that you know him, Greg, Sudhakar Mondithika.
Yes, I do. From India.
An MA in philosophy with us.
Right.
And he has been having a powerful ministry of speaking to scientists, to graduate students, to lawyers, to the intellectual elite in India, because far too many missionaries go there and work with the untouchables and the lower classes, which is important, but we also need to reach the thinking people. So I just can't understand why it can't be a both and, but I will tell you that the experiential power of the kingdom, while important, is certainly not a substitute for apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
For defending the faith, we're a whole-orbed religion. It's not an either-or; it's a both-and.
You know, I don't know the place in Acts. I'm trying to find it right now, but there was there was a guy that was. Paul was preaching the gospel, okay, and then there was some sorcerer guy that was hanging around, Simon Magus or something, I don't know, but he was trying to distract the process, and it said that the person that Paul was speaking to was an intelligent man, and then he went on to speak persuasively about the gospel, and then there were signs and wonders, and then it says he was persuaded,
yes. And
it wasn't because he was amazed at the teaching of the Lord, and see, I thought it was a passage that really captured. It wasn't like just all the razzmatazz of miracles, but there was substance there, and Paul was appealing to his mind. And yes, he had to deal. Oh, I think it was the guy that Paul struck blind because he was interfering. You know, he's annoying.
Yeah.
And finally, he struck him blind and he got rid of him. And it was this act of power plus the teaching that was the package that this intelligent man responded to. Being amazed at the teaching of the Lord.
Well, you're so right about that, Greg, and it really is, it is a both and. And what's so funny is that when these people become converted in these third world countries, they just wouldn't, they're not going to be postmodern.
Yeah.
This kind of postmodern relativism in our country just wouldn't wash for those people. They,
right. They're
too, they know too much.
Well, this raises a question then, and I know there are a whole bunch of people that are thinking this question right now. Why them and not us? That is, why the movement of the Spirit in this powerful, visible, persuasive way in all of these countries where none of us are at right now. And I know that there are critics, skeptics that listen to the show, call in. We had one last hour.
Yes.
And I'm glad for that. But they're asking the question, well, look, why does God do that for those guys? Why doesn't he work a miracle for me? If I just saw a miracle, I'd believe too.
Yeah. That's a good question. I do think that those sorts of things have happened and are happening in the States, and they don't get told about it. Our church, for example, a couple of months ago, there was a Jewish woman. We have a prayer room on Monday night where we just pray for people.
You go to the Vineyard in Anaheim now, is that correct?
I do. Yeah, but I think more and more churches of all persuasions are beginning to have more of an outreach to the sick, and they're recovering the need to pray for the sick. And there was a Jewish lady who came four Monday nights, and on the fourth Monday night, she said and I talked to the guy who prayed over her, something is different. I feel like I've been healed. Now, she had 51 points of cancer in her body, 51. She was terminally ill. She went to the doctor less than 2 or 3 days later for x-rays. Her cancer was entirely gone. Mm. All 51 points were gone. And she became a Christian as a result of that. Now these things are happening in our country, but Charles Kraft at Fuller Seminary makes a very important point, Greg. He says that in our culture, we have really accepted a naturalistic worldview without knowing we've done it. And we really do think that all sickness is due to disease. You can't have a demonic component to it. And, of course, in my view, it's a both-and. But we tend to turn to medicine. We tend to think that the miracles were for the first century and that doesn't happen anymore. And that when people get converted in other parts of the world, their worldview is actually more biblical than
ours
is, because they believe in the unseen world.
That's right. You know, I frequently mention that we are, you know, products of our culture. The church always is in some measure, and we always have to be on guard, Paul says, to not be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception according to the traditions of men. And so we always have to be on our guard for that. But the fact is, here we are. You know, I'm speaking autobiographically here now, personally, JP, you know, coming out of that culture myself and being more left-brained about these kinds of things, which is maybe one of the reasons I'm in this business. It's just harder. I can't think of any other word. There is room in my worldview for this kind of thing, but it is more difficult for me to believe it actually will take place like that than I think for somebody that I used to work with in Thailand who sees demonic things happen on a regular basis. They're very in touch. It's part of their worldview that there's this very prolific supernatural world, and there are forces of evil. There are demonic spirits that actually make a difference. And so when Christianity comes in there, then there's this powerful work of the Holy Spirit, and they can move much more naturally. What do you suggest for people like me that are victims in a sense of our culture?
Then I'll give you a recommendation here. But I was talking to an ACSI school teacher, that's the Association of Christian Schools International, who was back from furlough. He teaches at a Christian school in Brazil. And he told me an event that a friend of his and another minister had just gone into a village where there was a 9-year-old boy that had a hernia protruding out of his stomach larger than a softball. It was grotesque looking. They went into this village and they laid hands on this boy, and right in front of their very eyes, it completely leveled and he was healed instantly. And it led all sorts of people to come to the Lord in that situation. Now, I don't think all this is tied to evangelism. I think some of it is just tied to the love and mercy of God. But
right.
You see, the point is that in that culture, people are more open to the supernatural, and there's kind of more of a faith that's available. I think what we have to do, I just wrote a book that just got published last week. It's probably not in the bookstores yet. Klaus Sissler and I wrote it. It's called The Lost Virtue of Happiness. And there's a chapter in that book about my own journey into depression and anxiety, and we can talk about that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
But in that book, I share a few of the stories of the supernatural that have even happened in my own life, and I list a series of credible books that people can read about these things. And I think what we have to do is twofold. First, we need to read credible witnesses, not crazy people, but credible people who have seen these things happen. It builds faith. I think, secondly, we need to start sharing our stories with one another. Let me explain. I've now gone into churches, and I've asked for a show of hands when I speak, how many people have been miraculously healed in a way that couldn't have been coincidence or placebo? And I would say about 5% of the congregation raises their hand.
That's actually
and
quite
I'll say, how many of you know someone that was healed? I don't mean two steps removed, but you know somebody, and about 60% of the congregation does.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a bit.
Well, it is. And so these things are I was at Rock Harbor Church speaking to their staff 2 years ago about praying for the sick. At the break, their sound equipment guy comes up to me and says, let me tell you what happened to me. And he said, a few years ago, I was in a machine shop, and a machine fell on me. It broke my chest and my hands. I went to the doctor, the emergency room. There were fractures in my hands and my chest. I was scheduled for surgery the next day. They gave me pain medication. I went home. A group came over from my church and prayed over me, and I was healed. And I said, well, how do you know you were healed? He said, well, I felt different. And then I went in for surgery the next morning. They took x-rays again, and the fractures were gone. Now, I said, how do you know they were gone? He said, what do you mean? I said, I saw the x-rays. I compared them. And I said, have you told anybody about this? And he said, well, no, I don't like talking about myself. And I said, you idiot. I said, you've got to share this with people. My hunch, Greg, is that these things are happening in our churches, but people don't talk about it because they don't want to look weird. And so I think what we've got to do is to begin to bear witness to one another more openly about the times we do see these things. Because while I don't think as much is happening as it overseas, a lot more happens in our churches than we know about because people just are hesitant to share them.
Well, I guess it's about 20 years ago now, maybe, well, 15, I had TMJ, which is a jaw problem, and I had a young lady pray for me and got healed of that, and that was it, you know. And I've mentioned that a few times, but it kind of slips my mind when I, you know, because it was a while back.
And I understand. And
that's something. But, I got other aches and pains. I'm 55, JP. You know how it is, you know.
Well, tell me about it, buddy.
I look at my little girl there. She's laying in her bed, and she's 13 months old, and I think, well, it would be great to crawl in that crib with her because I know nothing aches on her body yet, you know. It's just
absolutely.
It's just great. Well, here's another question, though, and we just got about two or three minutes left here in our time together. But I think part of the reluctance that people around here have, especially people that I think would be associated with the kinds of things that we do, you and I do, is the concern that there is a lot of things that passes for healing and the work of the Holy Spirit that they have no reason to believe is that because of the purveyors of this who are heretical or heterodox or just seem like they're lining their pockets or something.
Yeah, or it's fraudulent or weird.
Yeah, yeah. And so do you think that there's there's any activity that's illegitimate here?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think that that's a legitimate concern. And I think there is, unfortunately, a lot of some stuff out there that's overstated, it's exaggerated, it's not real, it's done for money, all that. And I completely think that it's wise to be cautious, but I don't think we should be cynical.
Right.
And I guess my view is I don't want to have anything to do with that stuff. That, you know, God bless them, but that is not who I want to be.
Maybe that's why
that in our ordinary fellowships.
Yeah, maybe that's why some people have asked me, said, boy, I can't believe that JP is into that stuff, because what they think of is of these other folks.
That kind of stuff weird turns me off. I don't want to have anything to do with that.
Right, right. One thing I appreciated about – you've written this book with Gary Habermas, Immortality, the Other Side of Death, where you talk about the soul and the afterlife and things like that and near-death experiences. And there's a care given as you approach these more extraordinary things, not to go beyond the evidence that we have, you know. Say, well, here's the evidence, and some people are saying all of this stuff, but really, to be fair, we can only go this far. So there's an appropriate restraint that I see, not only in that book, but in the kinds of things that you do, and that's part of what you're talking about
it's
now.
It's very much a part of what I'm talking about, Greg. Now, I'll admit that when this guy told me this, I didn't go ask to see his x-rays.
Right, right.
But, I mean you can get a read for somebody. And I could tell he was shooting straight. But,
sure. I mean,
I do think we have to be cautious and not over-exaggerate.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that many times things are happening, and people just don't hear about it because we don't share it with one another.
Well, I had a fellow call last hour, and he was raising questions about the miraculous in the Gospels, and he thought this seems like a myth, and that's why I offered some thoughts on it. And he said, "Well, couldn't it be that people could make these stories up?" I said, "Well, yeah, it could be that, but couldn't it be that these stories are also true?"
Right.
And he said, "Well, yeah, I guess it could be that they are." I said, "Great. Well, now we've got two options. Now, how do we decide which one's the case?"
Right.
And then we bring some other elements to bear on it, some more questions about historical analysis and
right.
the like.
Right.
But it is interesting that people will be very quick to try to explain away these kinds of things. Maybe it was psychosomatic. Well, maybe it was, but maybe it wasn't.
Well, absolutely. And this guy. The x-rays were taken within 24 hours of each.
Sure, yeah. In his case, he could actually produce some really quantifiable evidence,
absolutely.
And that's the case. But I think there's a sense in which even Christians are a little bit reluctant to kind of give the credit to God, and maybe we should err on giving him the credit rather than on the doubt. JP,
I think you're right. And I do think we have to be cautious, but not overly cynical.
Yeah.
Just wise. I think we have to be wise.
It was great talking with you today, JP.
Okay. Always a privilege.
I look forward to doing it again before too long.
Bless you, my dear brother.
Thank you for all your help. Dr. J.P. Moreland, I can't list all the books here in 60 seconds that he's been involved with. He's over at Talbot, of course, Master's Program of Philosophy of Religion. I'm one of his students graduating in a couple of months, but he'll always be a friend. That's all the time that we have, ladies and gentlemen. Go out and be a good ambassador for Christ this week. I'm Greg Kokel. You go out and give him heaven, all right? Bye-bye now.